beyond game-changing, huge, enormous.
Considering the potential of shale oil development on Alaska's North Slope. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 31st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, turning garbage into gas at the Anchorage landfill.
The energy we create with this plant will generate revenue for the city, provide energy security for the Joint Base, all using what until now was an undesirable byproduct of city waste collection.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
There's growing interest in developing shale oil on Alaska's North Slope. A conference on the topic in Anchorage today drew a sellout crowd. The potential resource on the North Slope is enormous, but there are also big challenges that may make it hard for companies to economically develop the oil. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
4 years ago, Dave Hausnecht, a research geologist with the United States Geological Survey, started looking into the oil and gas potential in shale rock on Alaska's North Slope. Then, at a lease sale in 2010, Great Bear Petroleum snapped up North Slope leases with the intention to begin exploratory shale oil drilling.
When Great Bear suddenly appeared at the lease sale 2 years ago and picked up the acreage, we were asked to accelerate our evaluation by DNR because that kind of caught them by surprise.
Hausnecht's assessment came out earlier this year. It shows the North Slope has a huge amount of oil and gas trapped in shale rock, as much as 2 billion barrels of recoverable oil. That amount is second only to the massive Bakken Reserve in North Dakota. A lot of it is locked in a rock formation called the Shublik, and Hausnecht says the shale, or source rock, isn't like anything that's currently being developed in the lower 48, and that could make the oil hard to extract.
To be truthful about it, it's difficult to find an analog that fits the Shublik really well anywhere in the world. So I think what we're doing is probably breaking new ground on a type of source rock that has a mineralogy that's quite unique.
Hausnecht says the oil on the North Slope also tends to be more viscous than in the lower 48 shale formations, and that also might complicate the production process. But those downsides don't seem to be deterring industry interest.
Do you get calls from oil companies, though, that are interested?
All the time. All the time.
Only one company, Great Bear Petroleum, is currently exploring the resource potential. The company began field work this summer, drilling vertical wells into the Shublik formation. Pat Galvin is a vice president of external affairs at Great Bear. He says the results from those test wells will be trickling out over the next few years, and he says it's hard to predict what they will show.
If we have something that is relatively thin, then we're going to have to really sharpen our pencils to come up with an economic project. If we have a fairly large success, then it'll be a much more clear-cut answer in terms of whether the economics are going to work.
Galvin says developing the resource in Alaska will be expensive, and the company will have to figure out how to bring costs down. Galvin is a former Alaska Revenue Commissioner under Governor Palin, and that gives him insight into how shale oil development would impact the state's budget.
It will create a whole new industry of oil and gas development on the slope that we hadn't included in any of our previous forecasts, and that will really establish a much more secure long-term base for the state's economy.
That assessment is relatively tame compared to the one State Senator Joe Pascvan has to offer.
Beyond game-changing, huge, enormous.
The Fairbanks Democrat thinks shale oil may be the answer to the question of how to get more oil flowing through the Trans-Alaska pipeline system. So far, only one company, Royal Energy, appears to be following Great Bear's lead, but Pascvan predicts others will soon.
If Great Bear does very well in their and proving up this process, I think that there will be many independents following Great Bear to Alaska, because the magnitude of our resource is so large.
The energy-focused law firm that organized the conference, K&L Gates, originally planned to have 75 participants. 300 people signed up before they had to start turning people away. Paskvan says that kind of turnout is evidence the shale oil boom that took off in North Dakota 4 years ago may be about to hit Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The Parnell administration is beginning to consider what needs to be done with the state's tax on gas production. Currently, it is coupled with the oil tax regime, but legislators were told Monday that it's time to begin planning a new system to encourage gas line development for in-state use as well as for export. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Gas exploration companies and the Parnell administration are anticipating an alignment of interests this fall that could make it easier to deliver natural gas from the North Slope to South Central and the Rail Belt. Part of that alignment will be the development of a gas tax regime that reflects what Deputy Natural Resources Commissioner Joe Balash calls an effort for the state to, quote, recalibrate its thinking. He told the legislature's in-state gas caucus that a gas pipeline project from the North Slope was originally based on sending gas to the lower 48. The focus now is on exporting liquefied gas to Pacific markets.
The original construct of AGEA had within it upstream inducements that were made available for that first open season, but because there were no firm transportation commitments resolved there, those particular inducements are no longer statutorily available. So we recognize the need to adjust a few things relative to those kinds of inducements for an LNG-focused project.
Natural Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan says there's been no specific element of a new tax regime yet considered, saying staff's looking at broad principles while considering the options as a project comes together. He told legislators that oil and gas companies, along with the state and TransCanada Pipeline Company, are still coming up with details for an export project, with results expected this September. Balash said legislators should have a new plan to consider during next year's session.
When January rolls around, I think there's a reasonable expectation that the governor's going to keep oil tax legislation on the front burner, and that there will be some means of addressing natural gas, be it commercialization or in-state use or both. Exactly how or what we do as an administration will be determined in that time frame. It's premature to say with any degree of specificity what that will look like.
The Gas Caucus also got updates from the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation on its plans for a smaller gas line to Fairbanks, the Rail Belt, and South Central. CEO Dan Fowsky said the project is behind schedule for holding an open season next year because lawmakers did not provide sufficient funding for all the work leading up to the offering. However, he said, planning work is still continuing, and new budgets are now being prepared that will fit in with expectations of more commercial alignment this fall. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Exxon's Point Thompson gas and oil project is being prepared for the final step toward getting approval from the federal government. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Friday released its environmental impact study on the project that Exxon says has cost the company $1 billion in investment so far. The study is the result of 3 years of review. Project manager Lee Bruce told the legislature's gas caucus yesterday that Point Thompson will have the pipe capacity to send 70,000 barrels of oil per day through the Trans-Alaska pipeline. However, the first phase will only ship 10,000 barrels.
My project is to cycle gas out of the reservoir, strip out the liquids, send the liquids by a pipeline to Badami, then all the way eventually into TAPS, and we're re-injecting the gas back into the ground. That's what this first phase of Point Thompson development is all about.
Bruce says the EIS is essential to the project's advancement, but there are other permits on the way. He says Point Thompson is key to gas development on the North Slope, with 25% of the known resources that could go to market. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, producing a high school musical in record time.
This process is one of the more excruciating artistic things I've been put through, and I say that in lightest words possible just because it's fun.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at FNBAlaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
A military jury has sentenced a Fort Wainwright-based soldier in the death of a fellow Stryker Brigade member. Sergeant Adam Holcomb of Youngstown, Ohio, will forfeit about $1,200 in pay, have his rank reduced, and serve 30 days in confinement. He was convicted yesterday in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, of maltreatment of a subordinate and assault in the death of Private Danny Chen last year in Afghanistan. Holcomb was found not guilty of negligent homicide. Prosecutors said Holcomb physically and emotionally abused Chen, driving him to take his own life. But Fayetteville Observer reporter Drew Brooks, who attended the trial, says the defense successfully raised another factor that could have led Chen to suicide.
They really pounded hard on the allegations that Chen's family had disowned him. That's something that Chen's family had vehemently denied throughout the trial, and other people testified was not the case. But there were several soldiers in Chen's units who repeatedly said that Chen told them that his family had disowned him.
Holcomb is the first of eight Fairbanks-based soldiers court-martialed for the alleged racial hazing of Private Chen, who killed himself in October 2011. Chen graduated from basic training in April 2011, arrived at Fort Wainwright in May, and was shipped out to Afghanistan as replacement for a forward operating base in August. Brooks said witnesses described Chen as a soldier who wasn't ready for the combat zone.
He didn't get any appropriate training at Fort Wainwright. And to hear both sides, witnesses for both sides put it, he was pretty much thrown into a situation he was completely unprepared for.
The Chen case trials are taking place at Fort Bragg because the Fort Wainwright-based Stryker Brigade was under the command of a Fort Bragg general while deployed in Afghanistan. Officials fired up the state's first methane power plant at the Anchorage Regional Landfill today. Doyon Utilities built the $26 million plant this summer. It uses methane gas created by decomposing garbage to create electricity. Doyon Utilities, the Municipality of Anchorage, and Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson partnered on the project. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
That's the sound of the new methane-fueled power plant at the Anchorage Regional Landfill near Eagle River. And in case you're wondering, it doesn't stink. Dignitaries gathered to celebrate completion of the plant, which has been in the making since 2004. Dan Gavora is the president of Doyon Utilities. He says the plant is a win for all involved.
The energy we create with this plant will generate revenue for the city, provide energy security for the Joint Base, lower overall energy costs, and reduce pressure on local energy infrastructure and resources, all using what until now was an undesirable byproduct of city waste collection, an emission that had to be collected and flared to meet environmental protection standards.
It's also a win for Doyon Utilities. The company owned by Doyon Limited and Fairbanks Sewer and Water was created in 2005, specifically to service the military installations in Alaska. The plant will offset the power usage for the Fort Richardson part of J-Bear in Anchorage. The landfill was creating methane gas anyway, but until now they were flaring it as required by EPA guidelines. Now, instead of being released into the atmosphere as pollution, it's being funneled into a 6,000-foot pipeline leading to the plant.
It comes in, we reduce it down to 1.5 pounds, goes into the turbocharger, goes into the engine, it burns the gas, drives the generator, and makes electricity.
That's Marvin Riddle. He's managing the project for Doyon Utilities. The plant's equipped to burn methane from the landfill and natural gas. When there's not enough methane, it'll switch over to using the natural gas. Right now, it produces 5.6 megawatts of power feeding directly into the grid. That offsets J-Bear Richardson's summer power usage by 80% and supplies 55% of their winter power needs. There's room for expansion as the city, the base, and the landfill grow. The plant is in part a result of a renewable energy goal set by the Department of Defense in the early 2000s. Colonel Brian Duffy is the commander of Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson and the commander of the 673rd Air Base Wing. He says the plant just made sense.
When you've got a landfill that's got to be tended to, a privatized partner in the utility system like Doyon, and the electrical demand that the base has, and is honestly is competing for supplies that also affect the local community, it just made a lot of sense to move forward with this project, and we're glad to see it come through today.
The Anchorage Assembly awarded Doyon Utilities the project in 2011, and it was completed this summer with the aid of a $2 million construction grant by the Alaska Energy Authority. Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan was on hand to celebrate the project. He says he's excited about the many independent power projects being developed in South Central Alaska.
We know that, across the inlet, Oramat's looking for geothermal possibilities. We've got, of course, the Wautana Dam looks like it's moving forward. Hydro certainly is renewable. Some of the coal seam projects may not be true renewables, but they're certainly unconventional, and the ability to use coal without mining it and burning it in the atmosphere is exciting. And, of course, the wind farm, maybe by this fall, we'll see some turbines spinning for the wind farm. So a lot of exciting things happening in renewable energy resources.
Officials say the municipality is expected to collect over $51 million in revenue from the sale of its landfill gas fuel supply and project-related property tax revenue over the 20-year term of the contract. The federal government will obtain electricity at a lower cost, with an estimated savings of $32 million over that period. And J-Bear will exceed its federally mandated goals for renewable energy. Methane power plants are quite common in the lower 48, but this is the first one in Alaska, and likely the only one for a while. According to officials, Anchorage is the only city in the state big enough to supply enough garbage and methane to produce power. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The brand new Gateway Aquatic Center in Ketchikan held its grand opening last weekend. The $24 million center was swamped with people eager to swim, slide, splash, and play. KRBD's Layla Carey has the story.
Ketchikan's new 35,000 square foot aquatic center is not just a pool. It's an 8-lane competition pool with 1- and 3-meter diving boards. It's a warm water pool for kids and therapy activities. It's a vortex pool for aqua jogging. It's water slides and a water playground. It's a rock climbing wall with a water landing. It's also very popular. Less than a week after a quiet opening on July 23rd, the line of people waiting to get into the afternoon open swim wound out the door. Aquatic supervisor Karen Taylor says that's been fairly typical so far.
It's real exciting. We're maxing out our numbers every day. As you can see, there's lots of kids out here. Been just really busy.
Taylor says the feedback has been positive.
The kids are really liking it. The adults, the teenagers, there's something for everybody here. We're still working on a few little things, but overall everybody's real impressed with it.
Those few little things include the best places for lifeguards. Several keep an eye on the slides alone. The slides do appear to be a highlight, with a line of soaking wet kids shivering and grinning as they wait patiently for their next trip down. Alex Bolshikov says she likes the drop slide best.
When you fly out, you don't expect it coming, and yeah, it's just like you're in the water.
Does the water go up your nose?
Well, if you plug it, it does.
Yeah.
Ketchikan High School swim season begins on August 6th. K-High will show off the community's new pool to visiting swim teams on August 24th when it hosts a meet with Metlakatla, Petersburg, and Thunder Mountain. In Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
At the high school level, putting on a musical can take anywhere from 8 to 10 weeks. At the Sitka Fine Arts Camp, it takes 2. A group of high school-age students completed the ambitious rehearsal schedule at the camp's first-ever 2-week musical theater session last week. KCAW's Ed Ronco visited rehearsals for Bye Bye Birdie.
Conrad, oh yes we do. We love you, Conrad, and we'll be true when you're not near.
It's Monday, July 16th, and this is the first rehearsal for Bye Bye Birdie. The young cast is seated around the outside edges of a circular chapel on Sheldon Jackson campus. In the middle, music director Andrew Hames explains the show. Conrad Birdie, the title character, is basically Elvis. Skinny, postage stamp Elvis, not sweaty jumpsuit Elvis.
And so when he signed up for the military, teenage girl hearts broke across the country that, oh my gosh, he's going off to fight in the war, but we have to support that.
Birdie is coming to the small town of Sweet Apple, Ohio, where he will perform one last song before he heads overseas. The cast begins by reading through the script. When they get to a song, they speak it.
Gray skies are going to clear up and put on a happy face. Brush off the clouds and cheer up, put on a happy face. Take off the...
But don't let this fool you, because 3 days later, this cast is singing, dancing. They've memorized Act 1, and they're working hard on Act 2.
There are chicks... just right for the kissing, and I mean to kiss me a few. Man, those chicks don't know what they're missing. I've got a lot of...
And by that evening, they've added an orchestra.
Sister's cakes, all ready for tasting. And there's Cadillacs.
And by midway through this week, costumers are fitting cast members, the crew and community volunteers are painting the set, and the cast is doing a lot of polishing.
Putting up a Broadway musical, they take 5 weeks. We're putting up a musical in 2.
Elida Kaur is from Portsmouth, Rhode Island. She plays Rose.
This is a very different character for me because I've never been Spanish before. Spanish? Okay, May, I'll be Spanish. Just wait until I marry Alberto. The toast of Chi-Chi. It's really long days, difficult hours, but from the first moment we all walked into the room on day one, we all knew, like, this is going to be fun but professional, and we're just going to get it done, and we're going to have loads of fun doing it.
Not Danish, not British, not Swedish, not Yiddish, but
My name is Gavin Strumpler. I was born in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm Albert Peterson, Bye Bye Birdie. He's a pushover in every sense of the word.
No, I'm not suggesting the boy doesn't want to go into the army. It's just that, no, I'm not trying to. Well, it seems to me that 2 weeks from today, at the induction center, he'll be there.
This process is one of the more excruciating artistic things I've been put through, and I say that in lightest words possible, just because it's fun.
Strumpler says the all-day rehearsal schedule is developing a work ethic in the cast, and many, like him, want to do this professionally.
My experience of working with young people is if you set a bar, they'll attain it.
That is W.T. McRae, the director of theater at Sitka Fine Arts Camp. He says that at the first read-through, there was a lot going through his mind.
Did we choose right? Are these kids going to be successful in this area? And am I, you know, challenging each kid? I want to make sure that it's not simple for anyone, that there's learning happening here.
Musical theater, he says, is a chiefly American art form. It was created here, it has evolved here, and it is thriving here. And for students in the arts, it is a confluence of all the skills they've learned.
I believe that the theater makes great citizens. And I think if these kids can learn these skills and take them on to any endeavor that their passion drives them to, they're going to be better off for it.
There are lots of philosophical reasons behind why these students wake up early, perform and rehearse all day, go to bed late, and repeat the process. But at this moment, they're focused on the practical ones. Opening night is not that far away. There are costumes to fit, there are dances to perfect, notes to fine-tune, and lines to remember. And beyond that, well, who knows?
Ed Sullivan, they're gonna be on Ed Sullivan.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
One of the pillars of Alaska's philanthropic community died yesterday at her home in Anchorage. Mary Louise Rasmussen was 101. Along with her husband Elmer, she had been active in the work of the Rasmussen Foundation and was responsible for influencing the direction of community work within Alaska First and also expanding the foundation's work throughout the nation. As chair of the Anchorage Museum Foundation, she was instrumental in creating the Anchorage Museum of Art and History in 1968. Later, the Anchorage Museum at Rasmussen Center. Those who worked with her say she preferred to remain out of the public spotlight. Steve Lindbeck is president and CEO of Alaska Public Telecommunications, the parent company of APRN. He says she was a major philanthropic and civic force in Alaska.
She had a great devotion to arts and culture, to health, obviously, to community processes all over the place. It was remarkable the way, she would send a note to someone who was doing something interesting, and it would kind of come out of the blue, but it would make people realize that she was paying close attention, and she was visible and supportive and, able to make things happen in a quiet, gracious, very classy way.
Prior to her marriage to the National Bank of Alaska's Elmer Rasmussen and her move to Alaska, Mrs. Rasmussen had risen through the ranks to become the commandant of the Women's Army Corps in 1957, the public face of military women. But Rasmussen Foundation President Diane Kaplan says that her role changed in the state, where she preferred to work from the back of the room.
It was a very different role for her when she came to Alaska. Before that, she was always very front and center, and then she assumed a very different role here. So her influence was really very gentle and behind the scenes, and she gave direction to a lot of people and influenced a lot of people, but in a very quiet way.
Kaplan says she had remained engaged in the work and projects supported by the foundation, dealing with grants and personnel as recently as 2 weeks ago. A funeral mass will be held September 10th at Our Lady of Guadalupe Church in Anchorage. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Stacia Eaton in Anchorage, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Era Alaska. For more than 30 years, Era Alaska has been transporting packages across the state, business documents, medical supplies, even family pets. More details at flyera.com or talk to your local Era Alaska agent. Era Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. Avtech is recruiting rural Alaskans for computer and network training with no cost tuition for qualified applicants. For more about the Village Internet Agent Program, call 1-800-478-5389. This message sponsored by Avtech, Alaska's Institute of Technology. For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at alaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.